From runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 318 with guest Steve Evans, recorded Friday, May 3rd, 2013. Run As Radio is produced each week by Pwop Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and thanks for listening to Run As Radio. I'm in San Francisco at Tech Days and having a great time doing a presentation on DevOps. We did the panel for women in IT as well, which is going to be published by the time you're hearing this, because I've got Steve Evans with me. Good to see you again, sir.
How's it going, Richard?
Things are good. And we end up talking all day anyway, but it's nice to actually pull the microphones out and talk a little shop. What have you been working on these days?
Well, actually, before we get started, you lost a bet last night.
Yes, I did. It was the very first game of the first round of the Stanley Cup playoffs, Canucks versus Sharks.
How'd that go?
Not so good. 3-1 for the Sharks. Nimi was awesome. Right? I mean, Nimi was awesome.
And I was going to say thank you, but I really had nothing to do with it.
It had nothing to do with that. And I don't think Leon Longo was all that bad, but his defense let him down.
So, unfortunately, I don't get to see the games thanks to Comcast, but... I saw some highlight clips. Yeah,
I went to the bar with Beth Massey, mm-hmm. and we drank scotch and watched the game. And she's a Sharks fan too. It was a challenge to be down here and be seriously outnumbered. the outcome of the game was made it easier for everyone involved except for me.
Yeah. Well, hopefully by the time this publishes, I don't have to eat my words.
Yeah. By then, San Jose will be out, and you know that'll be that. It won't matter anymore anyway.
This will be the year. Short season, old team.
Yeah, it's a good point. Well, I would almost think the Canucks have already come, you know, hit their peak a couple of years ago with the Game 7 debacle. And but, yeah, okay, let's let that go. That's enough. And if everybody ever wondered, yeah, no, I actually do like hockey.
All right, we'll be out of time now.
Well, that's all we've got. Thanks so much. Enough hockey. Let's talk Hyper-V.
Okay.
What's your project? What are you doing?
So... The thing I've been spending a lot of time on, there's like this trifecta. Mm. Not trifecta, a dualfecta. my day job,
yeah.
I'm doing a project that has this heavy dependency on Server 2012 hypervisors.
Okay.
And right now we're like the Hyper-V shop, you know, worldwide. Mm-hmm. We're the Hyper-V shop. And, you know, we're struggling through the 2008 R2 challenges. And we actually did a show about a lot of those challenges.
Yeah, I remember.
6 months ago or something. Mm-hmm. And so now we're working on this Server 2012 hypervisor architecture.
2012's been out for a while now. You've had a few months to really hammer away at it.
Yeah, we started working on this in earnest in February.
Mm-hmm.
And around the same time, I was asked to do the Server 2012 overview session at MMS.
Mm-hmm.
A few weeks ago.
Which seems like an impossible goal. There's just so much stuff in Server 2012.
Yeah, I know. You definitely have to kind of scale it down.
Yeah.
I took the, you know, my story arc was, you know, this is the cloud. This is everything Microsoft learned from Azure and yeah. pushed down.
Which into, yeah, exactly what 2012 yeah. is, right?
You know, like NIC teaming is a perfect example. So
yeah.
Server 2012, you can do native NIC teaming now. You don't have to use the Intel or the Broadcom.
Right.
You know, am I allowed to say crappy? On the show.
Yes.
You know, it's like, oh, it's almost like someone at Microsoft said, oh, we don't really want to deal with that third party NIC teaming software, so we'll just write our own.
Right.
And then now it's trickled down into, you know, the OS that everyone else gets.
And plus, you don't, I mean, I remember NIC teaming in the old days where it mattered what NICs you got, what version of the ROMs were in them, like firmware settings, all that stuff mattered.
Sure. Yeah.
It's hairy.
And so the native NIC teaming is vendor agnostic. If
right.
you could find 32 NIC vendors and put them all in the same box, you could have a 32 NIC team from 32 different vendors and
nuts.
100% supported by Microsoft.
That's
and you
wild.
Could have a, you know, 10 meg cards to, you know, I just heard 100 gig Ethernet.
Wow. I was thinking about picking up a quad 1 gig card just to make it basically like a 4 gig LUN. You know?
Yeah, that's totally a viable option.
It's amazing.
And so kind of on top of that, is the extensible switch, the Hyper-V extensible switch, and then the virtual NICs on top of that. And so that gives us this concept we call converged fabric.
Okay.
And just think of it as separating out your physical implementation from your logical implementation.
Okay. And your logical implementation made up of a bunch of bits as well.
Your logical implementation is, so let's think about the R2 days.
Okay.
You needed a management NIC, you needed a live migration NIC, you needed a heartbeat NIC, you needed some iSCSI NICs probably, you needed some NICs to do the actual VM traffic.
Yeah.
And so you know, your physical implementation of your network was very dependent on what you needed from a logical implementation of Hyper-V.
Yeah.
With Server 2012 Converged Fabric, now we just have, it doesn't matter what the physical implementation are. We're going to team them together. We're going to put the switch on top of that, and we're going to build out VNICs. So, for example, let's say I have a box with two 10 gig interfaces.
Okay.
So I take those two 10 gig interfaces, team them together, put the extensible switch on top of that team, and then on top of that, I put my VNICs. So I'll have a VNIC for, say, management.
Yep.
I'll have a VNIC for live migrations. I'll have a VNIC for cluster communication. And then my VMs as well will plug into that. And now let's say 6 months from now, I buy some new hardware.
Mm-hmm.
And they have, instead of two 10 gig interfaces, they have four 10 gig interfaces.
Right.
Or they have eight 1 gig interfaces. So yes, the amount of bandwidth you have changes, but your logical implementation of your networking stack does not change.
Nice. Is in your mind, is this software-defined networking? It's just...
Yeah, I'm not good with buzzwords. So
yeah.
I mean, this is definitely an aspect of it.
Sure.
I think when most people talk about software-defined networking, and let's be careful, I'm not a network guy.
Okay.
So I just get to, I'll make stuff up and may or may not
and
be accurate.
And it sounds good, right? Right,
exactly. That's my specialty.
Nice.
So software-defined networking, I think most people would define that as network virtualization, which
right.
is basically the concept of, that's taking up another level of, you know, I have customer A, and they're going to have these networks over here, and it's going to sit on top of my physical implementation, my provider address space.
Mm-hmm.
And my customer address space is going to isolate all that traffic. So if I have, you know, the classic example, Pepsi and Coke in the same, you know, both on Azure, they can both be in there and they cannot talk to each other without going through the same pass that public traffic goes through.
Right.
And all sitting on the exact same hardware.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, not too many people are running public clouds, so the Pepsi Coke scenario is not that interesting. The one I'm dealing with, where I'm working at right now, is development environments, where we want to be able to have a developer say, I want an environment with these four applications.
Right.
We want to provision those out, and we don't want it to be able to talk to the other development environment.
Right. It is in a virtual space, isolated from everything else, so they don't cross-talk to each other and confuse each other, much less do damage to real production.
And that's the real key, is that we can better control what it's able to talk to in production without doing a lot of work on the physical network implementation.
Right. And in the old days, you're exactly right. I'd lay a separate switch with a separate set of NICs for that test hardware, isolated from the rest of the network, just to make sure it was safe.
From a networking perspective, we could put the production SQL server and the five development SQL servers on the exact same hypervisor, and they cannot talk to each other.
Right.
Now, there's a lot of reasons why you probably don't want to do that,
but
from a network perspective, you can do that.
Well, and once you have that isolation, now you can move them to physical hardware. It's just not dependent on it.
Yes, exactly. The other real key one is, so let's say I have a development environment I'm working in, or let's say I have production and I'm working in it and we hit a bug.
Mm-hmm.
And we work around the bug, but now we want to go dig into this and figure out what's happening. We pick up copies of those hypervisors, bring them over to a separate hypervisor in its own customer address space. We don't have to change the IP configurations of all those VMs.
Mm-hmm.
And we could have a copy of production running over here and work against that bug we hit in production and figure out why.
Yeah, so you're able to basically clone an environment without colliding with anything.
Exactly.
Change as few factors as possible. Because how many times have we not been able to reproduce a bug because our test environment was enough different from a production environment that we just couldn't actually make a valid comparison?
Exactly, exactly. Or making a copy of production was just time and cost prohibitive.
Yeah.
It's just too much. Too much you'd have to change, too many concerns around breaking, you know, something that just wasn't going to
I built a few, you know, large-scale pre-production environments for big websites, and they were hugely expensive.
Yeah.
Especially when we got into the custom networking stuff. If you had to have a firewall or a load balancer or anything like that, they're pretty pricey. And which brings a fair question. It's like, how much, when we're talking about in the Hyper-V space for networking, how much of those kinds of things can we do in there as well? Or what happens when we want a hardware appliance in that equation?
Well, so let's say we want to do firewalling. Okay. We provide firewall type services. So we got a bunch of options. We can, we could have a VM running some type of software based firewall.
Yeah.
We could have, there are vendors that are, so the Hyper-V switch is now called the Hyper-V extensible switch.
Extensible.
And the extensible is the key part there. You can have vendors come in and extend it and add firewall technology, monitoring technology, really lots of different really cool things they can be, you know, doing there and not have to build a complete Hyper-V switch, just extend the existing switch.
Okay. Because, I mean, it logically just means, like you said, create a VM that hosts the firewall and then you configure your networking to route traffic through it.
So you can do that if you don't want to go with a third-party extension.
Right.
Or you can just get an extension that plugs into the hypervisor and you configure it at that level.
And I guess, yeah, the plug-in model basically means that that happens automatically.
Yeah.
A lot of that routing.
Not super familiar, but yeah, it's conscious of the environments and it would be much easier to manage.
And this seems way more sophisticated than what we ever did in R2.
Oh, yeah. R2 was, you know, VMware Workstation had features above R2 hypervisors.
So. How good is the visualizations? Like, can I literally draw out a network and it's going to be able to implement it for me? Or do I have to think this through?
With the network virtualization stuff?
Yeah.
You're going to have to think it through.
Yeah, okay. So
this is not a...
you don't do this off the top of your head.
This is not a check a box and we've got to implement it. Good. This is going to require some work. But it's, you know, when I sat down with my network team to discuss it with the network engineers, they saw it, you know, and it was basically like, look, here's what we need from a physical implementation standpoint. I need a address space for my provider address space. And then everything else will be taken care of on top of that. And they're like, okay, cool, awesome. Let us know when you need that VLAN.
Nice.
Yeah. As opposed to, you know, okay, all this network redesign that you would normally have to do to get that stuff going.
Sure.
One big thing we miss on the extensible switch is if you're a Cisco shop, Cisco has the Nexus 1000V. So you can have, if you have six Nexus switches at the core, you know, probably 5Ks, 7Ks, and 2Ks hanging off of that, your hypervisors are plugged into. You can replace the Hyper-V extensible switch with the Cisco 1000V switch. Mm-hmm. And you can manage your network as one big switch from core to the hypervisor. And so from a network perspective, you're plugging your VM into a Nexus switch.
Nice.
Into the Nexus switch.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
It's very, very, it's interesting to see more of the stuff get more cloud savvy or more really VM savvy. They understand what's going on.
That's because they did Azure.
Yeah. They've learned something. They've taken real feedback and dealing with that. Does it really make any difference how many NICs we have? Or like you were talking about using 10 gigs, but they're still pretty pricey.
Well, I mean, so it all comes down to what do you need.
Right.
So if you've got let's say you have, your hypervisor is got a pair of quad core processors and 32 gigs of RAM.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to get 3, 4, 5, 6 VMs on there, depending on the size.
Yep.
So 3, 4, 5, 6 VMs, they're not going to push that much traffic.
No.
But let's say, you know, the ones, my latest servers have 16, 24 cores, something like that, 190 something gigs of RAM.
Right.
They're going to be running 20, 30 VMs on it.
Right.
They're going to push a lot more traffic.
Yeah.
And so as your hardware scales up, your network has to scale up with it.
Yeah. If you had 30 servers, you'd be laying some pretty hefty networking down.
Potentially. Yeah. I mean, it depends on what the servers do. Mm-hmm. You can also have 30 servers that just sit around and twiddle their thumbs too.
Right.
So it all depends. But, you know, you need to have, it's more about, and this is the great thing about the converged fabric. You're separating out your logical implementation from your physical implementation.
Right.
If you need 2 gigs of traffic, get a pair of 1 gig NICs.
Right.
If you need 20 gigs, 40 gigs of traffic,
you're probably buying some 10 gig NICs.
Some 10 gig NICs.
And I also like the idea that I can just add more. Well, we saw this demo at Build back in 2011, right? The guy was literally just plugging additional cables in and things were going faster.
Yeah.
So if you've got the NICs there, you can just keep adding them into the fabric. You don't have to redesign the logical part of the network.
Exactly. Exactly. And vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
As things fail, your logical implementation doesn't change.
Right.
So let's say I have 4 1 gig NICs and I lose 3 of them. Yeah, things are going to be slow, but I didn't lose my iSCSI NIC. I didn't lose my management NIC.
Yeah,
I didn't lose functionality. I just lost bandwidth.
Right. You're not dependent on a given piece of hardware.
Exactly.
So what about failover scenarios, you know, clustering traffic and actually dealing with the idea that maybe that physical switch that those NICs are plugged into can go down?
Yeah. So there's a lot of thought you want to put into this.
Mm-hmm.
So ideally, you have at least two NICs plugged into two different switches.
Right.
So if you lose one NIC or one switch, it's, you know, fails
over.
You're
just losing half of your traffic. Yeah. You're not losing everything.
Exactly. You're not losing connectivity. You're just losing some bandwidth.
Let me say that again. You're losing half of your bandwidth. You're not losing any of your functionality.
Exactly. Right. And potentially, you're losing your bandwidth, but you're not losing any performance because
if you're not,
presumably, you're not saturating your network.
Yeah.
That's definitely the type of things you want to think through. Also, when you're thinking about building out Hyper-V clusters, you want to think about, okay, I don't want that cluster as a whole to have single point of failures. So maybe it's this this set of hypervisors, this half of the cluster is plugged into this network equipment. Mm-hmm. This half of, this other half of the cluster is plugged into these other, this other set of network equipment.
Right.
They're in different racks with different PDUs. You know, just think through all those scenarios.
Sure.
When you build out any clusters on top of that, so virtualized clusters, make sure that they're in, you know, if you have a two-node SQL server, make sure they're in different Hyper-V clusters. Mm-hmm. So if you lose a cluster, you don't lose the SQL application sitting on top of that.
Right.
As you scale up, when you're doing virtualization, as you scale up, you have to think about a lot more. And I think that's the real key piece, is just think this stuff through.
It also seems like it's encouraging you to create a NIC for every distinctive purpose. Like, you're going to end up making more virtual NICs than you ever would have made in physical NICs. Like I say, it's obvious that we want a management NIC and front side NIC and your clustering NIC and live migration and so forth. But, you know, I almost think I would, often cases I found where I'm sharing a NIC to move the data traffic as well as the web traffic, because it was simpler and we didn't want to plug those additional NICs in. Now I'm being encouraged, like it's almost a security element to this. I'm being encouraged to create almost single purpose NICs.
Yeah, I mean, you have to think that through. So for example, a really good example of that is the management NIC, and what are you going to do about backups?
Right.
Should your backups go over the management NIC, or do you want to have a backup
NIC?
VNIC, VLAN.
Right.
And there's a pros and cons to both, and that's mm-hmm. definitely something you should think through. The nice thing about the converged fabric model is, if I have let's say today I do not have a backup VLAN.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say just the backup traffic just goes over your quote unquote, you know, public network.
Or over the administrative network thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's fine. Mm-hmm. And then 6 months from now you can change that, and you're not re-architecting your physical limitation.
Yeah.
You're just adding a new VLAN, adding a new VNIC for that VLAN, and off you go.
Right. So this is a logical piece. I mean, the only time you actually go around and actually move cables is because you're trying to increase the overall bandwidth.
Because you're changing your physical implementation, which is completely independent of what you're logically doing on your hypervisors.
Okay. And is this, do you feel like this stuff works the way it was advertised? Like you really can just plug stuff in and it keeps going?
So go find my MMS session.
Mm-hmm.
In the video of my session, I do a video. I show a video of the NIC team. So I'm running iPerf, which does memory to memory transfer.
Right.
So I'm running at 10 gigs a second.
You're pushing as hard as it'll go.
Hard as it will go. And I'm shutting down ports.
Hmm.
And you're just watching the traffic move from one NIC to another seamlessly.
Wow.
It works.
Okay.
When I was in, you know, we were in a conference room, we were doing that test, and there was like hugs and crying. I mean, it was.
People were pretty emotional about it just working.
And I don't know about you, but the number one problem I deal with is not performance, but reliability.
Yeah.
You know, being able to push 10 gigs, being able to push 10 gigs a second from VM to VM on different hypervisors. Yeah, that was cool.
Right.
The fact that I could be losing NICs left and right and not be losing
services.
Functionality, service, that's what really gets me excited.
Yeah, it changes. It's now physical is about overall bandwidth. And the virtual part, the logical part, is actual architecture.
Yeah.
Of how you want to pull things together. It's just a question of how easy it is to visualize it and diagnose it when it has problems.
Time will tell.
Mm-hmm. What do you do for IP strategies? Like, I presume you're using all internal IP addresses for all this. How far do you go with subnetting and the like?
Yeah, I mean, so I'm really the wrong guy to ask.
Okay.
But yeah, where I'm at, we're using all internal addressing. I mean, everyone's using internal addressing.
Yeah.
One cool tip is for any of your two tips around this. One, all of your NICs that aren't routable,
mm-hmm.
live migration NICs, heartbeat NICs,
right.
iSCSI NICs, make sure they're jumbo framed.
Right.
On that iPerf test, I got 10 gigs a second with jumbo frames, mm-hmm. 5.6 without it. Yeah, big difference, right?
So where you don't need to communicate out to the world, you can jump.
When I don't need to cross a router,
yeah,
use jumbo frame.
Yeah. Now, although most routers these days don't actually have problems with jumbo frames, but you always find one.
It's some old cheap
Wi-Fi access point that doesn't understand modified MTUs, and boom, off it goes.
So the second one is any NIC that's only being used for things like cluster communication, mm-hmm. live migrations, does not need a V4 address.
Oh, really?
In fact, clustering, failover clustering, will not use the V4 address. So you can go assign it a V4 address, and it will happily ignore it.
Right.
It's going to prefer the V6 network. So things like your live migration NICs, your heartbeat NICs, mm-hmm. just don't bother with V4 addresses. It will just use the V6.
Right. I mean, it's a strong case to be said for everything internal should be V6.
Yeah, again, you should go talk to Ed. I mean, I completely agree with you. The reality is that we're just not there. So many places, we're just not there yet.
Right.
When you're sitting down making the hard decisions about what's going to get done this year, you know, converting to V6 is just not that high on the list.
Well, because you're not going to ever use the IP address directly, which means every one of those NICs for every IPv6 assigned to it needs a name. Like, it all is going to need names. You have to, and then suddenly you have a lot of names.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, but the example of your live migration NIC, it does not need a name.
Okay.
It'll just figure it out.
Yeah.
Same with the heartbeat NICs and the CSV redirect and all that kind of stuff. I think the thing is, while there is.
I mean, effectively, the name of the NIC is the name of the IP as well. Effectively, you know, that's why you even know how to set the routes in the first place.
Well, you don't have to set up the routes. You're not routing them. Your heartbeat NIC's not getting routed.
Yeah.
Right?
But it's got aren't you setting up your network virtually to say these are the things that can see each other? They're actually, quote, plugged into each other.
Oh, yeah. So they're in, so you're VLAN tagging it.
Right.
You're saying this live migration NIC is on the live migration network.
Right. So these
network.
four V6 IPs are all part of the same VLAN. And that's the sum total of what you're describing. This is the live migration network. Is this set of these set of NICs?
Yeah,
can see each other.
So when you build your cluster, you get the cluster. It's going to build a cluster network for every subnet it sees.
Okay,
it's like your heartbeat NIC. Mm-hmm. It's just going to match up all your heartbeat NICs.
Right. Okay, because they've been all tagged as part of a given VLAN.
Exactly.
And that's the important part.
Exactly.
In some ways, that means it's even easier than really drawing the diagram. It's just creating those VLAN groupings.
Exactly. Yep. You just get them on the right VLAN, and they will find each other.
Yeah. Happy things will happen.
Magic happens.
Magic takes place. Forget about the rest. Yep. So, yeah, you don't need names for any of that. They don't have access to DNS.
You don't need names. You don't need V4 addresses. It just happens.
It just happens. That's really interesting.
Yep.
I mean, what about monitoring that traffic?
Monitoring things like live migration traffic?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you want to monitor it, have fun. But to what end? What's your goal?
I guess you're needing to know where... How do you know that your physical NICs are being saturated and what's saturated?
So you're watching your physical NICs.
Yes.
You're watching your physical ports.
They're telling me that they're saturated. They're not necessarily telling me what is saturating them.
Yes, but then you go up a level and you can track that down. You can look at the type of traffic through things like NetFlow.
Right.
You can look at source and destination.
So I'd probably be looking at the net traffic per VLAN to sort of see.
Just kind of depends what you're troubleshooting through, but yeah.
Sure. But I'm just trying to figure out who's the culprit for pinning my network to the wall.
It's live migration.
Yep.
No, I mean, really.
Yeah.
Live migration is memory-to-memory transfer.
Yeah. Right. Live migration is normally no consumption at all until it's consuming everything in sight.
Yep. In fact, one of the things you really want to pay attention to with Converged Fabric is applying some QoS.
Hmm.
And in fact, usually you're going to want to limit live migration traffic.
Right.
You don't want a live migration to overtake your Converged Fabric. You want to limit it to, you know, if you have a 10 gig NIC, limit it to 5 gigs of traffic, let's say.
Well, that's interesting because you're putting the QoS settings into the virtual fabric, but you're measuring it off the back of the physical fabric. So, do you actually want to do hard numbers there, or can I do percentages of traffic?
You can you can weight them.
Okay.
And so, it works out to percentages. So, you could say, for example, there's a few different ways you can do it. You can limit how much you can use. You can guarantee a certain amount,
mm-hmm.
or you can do percentages.
Mm-hmm.
And so, probably what you're going to do is percentages for most things, and then for like your live migration NIC, limit it to a certain, you know, to a...
Right.
I want to limit it to no more than
You can consume 50% of the network.
Yeah.
There's always got to be a certain amount of headroom. I mean, now you get into the fun spot of if there's more room, let them have more room, but it's lower priority.
Yeah. So QoS only kicks in when there's contention.
Okay. So everything's, so you do also have priority settings, essentially saying this has.
There, we could do a whole show on QoS. Not me, like but it. Someone could. I mean, QoS is its whole animal in and of itself.
And coming up with great strategies to actually, I mean, I've done this with physical networking. I've certainly not done it at this level. For the virtual stuff.
It's the same concept.
Yeah, I'm
What's
sure
the traffic
it is.
You care about? You care about iSCSI traffic? Mm-hmm. You care about heartbeats? You care about VM traffic maybe?
Yeah.
What kind of traffic do I not care about? Live migration.
Yeah.
If my live migration takes four times longer because it wasn't prioritized, mm-hmm. that's what you want.
Right.
You want everything else to beat
everything
out.
Else kept working. Yeah.
Now, on the note of live migrations, I took a VM. I have two clusters set up in the exact same hardware, mm-hmm. exact same network config and everything. One's R2, one's 2012. Mm-hmm. R2 cluster, VM with 64 gigs of memory in use. I used a tool to make sure all that memory is in use because that's what matters. The live migration process copies over active memory. Took 11 and a half minutes. You want to take a stab at how long the 2012 cluster took?
How long?
I appreciate you not saying like 5 seconds.
No, because that's ridiculous.
Exactly. And then my whole story here is just ruined.
Right.
65 seconds. 11 times faster.
Wow. Roughly.
Yeah,
that is stunning.
It's a huge, it's a game changer.
Sure.
Now
makes it trivial.
It's not only is it trivial with ClusterWare updating. Once again, this is obviously a Azure feature, mm-hmm. something that Microsoft's like, oh, this sucks. We got to make things better.
We got to make this awesome.
ClusterWare updating. You can just ClusterWare updating basically is Windows patching that is aware of the fact that it's a cluster, so it doesn't reboot every node in the cluster at 3 a.m. And so it will go through one by one and move the things off of it, patch that node, go to the next
restart
one, move things
it.
Off of it, patch that. Yeah, exactly. Go through the patch cycle. And the fact that we can live migrate things 11 times faster and do multiple live migrations mm-hmm. at a time allows us, you know, to do that
makes
in less
feasible.
Than a month.
But I like that idea that we're talking about taking every Hyper-V off of a host server without ever taking anything down. Then patching that host server and then transferring the loads back to it automatically.
Automatically.
That's pretty amazing.
Yep.
Yeah. Awesome stuff. Anything else? I think we pretty kind of pinned this networking side thing to the wall, but you know, what's your other favorite areas?
I mean, we could go on and on about 2012, just around hypervisors, but from networking perspective, I mean, just think things through. And really make sure you focus on Converged Fabric. When you're looking at iSCSI, be really, really conscious of how MPIO works. Mm-hmm. Really think that through. And you want to make sure that MPIO is building paths. You're ensuring that it's building paths around different physical hardware and not building this two redundant paths over the same physical switch.
Right. And you know, again, you get back to that, how much virtual has to understand about physical to be safe.
Yeah.
Although I'm wrestling with iSCSI these days. Now with SMB3, like, why do I need iSCSI?
You want to do another show? I think that's a really interesting question 5 years from now.
Okay. You don't feel like SMB is ready yet.
It's not so much that I don't think SMB, I don't think the ecosystem's ready.
Okay. I've got people who are not ready to give up their fiber channel, man. Like, I know exactly what you're talking about. Like, they're looking at iSCSI like it's still this bizarre, weirdo world that they don't want to go near. I've got my fiber and I'm happy. Leave me alone.
I think there's definitely a piece of that. I think, you know, if I'm looking at, say, NetApp filers, mm-hmm. they don't have SMB V3. Or I think I heard they just have V3 functionality, but it's, you know, it's new.
It's really new. And you don't want to take risks when you come to your storage.
Exactly.
I'm really fascinated by Microsoft's general movement, and I think these exchange guys have started this more than anything, away from SANs.
So, when you speak at a Microsoft conference, they do the tech check.
Yep.
Or whatever they call it. So, you know, like a month before, you talk to someone, usually from the product team or an evangelism team, just about what are you going to be talking about, and just make sure everyone's on the same page. And I got to the storage section, and I didn't have storage spaces on the list. And the guy said, oh, you missed storage spaces. And I said...
I didn't miss it.
I said, oh, yeah, I think storage spaces is cute and all, but, you know...
You called it cute!
And probably. Maybe not to his face, but... But I said, you know, I think it's cool for, like, small business, but it's not an enterprise feature. And he's like, yeah, you're right. It's only for small companies, like, you know, Azure, for example. I was like, okay, I'll go take a look at it. Right. So I dug into it. Mm-hmm. And I think in server 2015 or whatever it is, I think storage spaces is going to be a game changer.
It's going to own it.
Yeah.
When you understand,
I think for branch offices right now, storage space is a game changer.
Right.
You can implement a, I don't even want to call it entry level, a mid-level SAN for a tenth of the price.
Right.
You know, instead of spending 50 grand on that entry level SAN, you can go spend 10, 15 grand.
Instead of buying NetApp or an EMC, now I literally buy a 28 drive server, run storage space.
Or a SaaS enclosure and two physical servers, and you can cluster that.
Yeah.
And you can do scale out file services or iSCSI target from there.
Mm-hmm.
Your Hyper-V workload, your SQL workload over SMB v3. I think that's a game changer. I think there's some features missing.
Yeah.
As in, I can only have two physical servers. I have to have the SaaS enclosure, the external SaaS enclosure.
That reminds me of the original clustering for SQL Server, where we literally had to be on the same SCSI cable.
Yeah.
You know?
It feels like 1995.
It's a V1 product. Yeah.
But just go look at Azure Storage and look at Storage Spaces, and specifically how in Storage Spaces you can do the triple replication. Then look at what Azure Storage does.
Right.
And then think about what maybe they'll be doing in the future. I don't know. I have no inside knowledge on this. But to me, it's pretty obvious where things are going to go.
Sure. And like I said, this is a V1 product for them.
Exactly.
So
it's a very interesting V1 product. I think if I was a greenfield shop, I'd be looking at it. I was looking
really
at a branch
wrestling.
Office scenario,
yeah,
I'd be definitely looking at it.
But you're not ready to kick your NetApp out the door.
You're not replacing your enterprise SAN yet.
Yeah. But it's being threatened.
Definitely.
It's awesome. Always fun to talk to you, Steve.
Thank you.
Go Canucks. And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.